From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
President Trump in search of the ultimate deal. Hello again, I'm Marvin Almy, and this is To the Point. President Trump is talking peace between Israelis and Palestinians without any detailed plan to confront the all-important core issues between them. Today, he met with Mahmoud Abbas, but Palestinians are divided between his Fatah faction and Hamas, located in Gaza. Mr. Trump then followed up with a speech that failed to mention the two-state solution, which divides Israelis. As he moves on to Rome, we'll update the president's first try at international diplomacy in one of the world's most complex and confusing regions. Meantime, in Washington, intelligence officials respond to reports of collusion between the president's campaign and Russia, as we'll hear later on today's Talking Point. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. On his first foreign tour, President Trump has promised peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Are there any details for restarting talks that have been stalled for the past 3 years? That's our main topic today. On our Talking Point, former and current officials often go off the record. Today on Capitol Hill, top intelligence officials, past and present, went on the record about the Trump campaign and possible connections to Russia. First, this news update. Last night's suicide bombing at a concert by American pop star Ariana Grande killed at least 22 people and hospitalized 59 more in Manchester, England. Condolences are pouring in from all over the world. Chief Constable Ian Hopkins said this to reporters.
The man suspected of carrying out last night's atrocity is 22-year-old Salman Abidi. However, he has not yet been formally named by the coroner, and I wouldn't wish to therefore comment any further about him at this stage. Our priority, along with the police counter-terrorist network and our security partners, is to continue to establish whether he was acting alone or working as part of a wider network.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. Rukmini Kalmaki is reporting on terrorism for the New York Times. She focuses on ISIS and al-Qaeda. Good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
How do you take that ISIS claims responsibility for this, and how likely is it that there were others involved?
ISIS has been remarkably disciplined in only claiming attacks that either their fighters carried out themselves or that they inspired. And that's the key thing that you need to understand. They consider inspired attacks, which are attacks that are carried out by people who are merely imbibing their propaganda online, they consider those to be just as much their handiwork as something like the Paris attacks. So within that framework, I think that we need to take this claim seriously.
We should take also seriously the fact that this occurred at a very large arena in Manchester, England, and that most of the people there were teenagers. The ISIS release on this subject calls them crusaders.
Yes, ISIS has made very clear that that no civilian is safe in what they call the land of the infidels, land al-Kufr, and they consider children to be just as much a target as anybody else, and they have repeatedly said that this is in retaliation for aggressions against Muslims in their territory, including in the release today.
There are reports that this was a nail bomb. Does that say anything particularly about how ISIS operates or not?
Not specifically. We've seen nails are the nail is not the actual bomb. The nail is the projectile that is added inside the mixture in order to cause maximum damage. And for example, in the Paris attacks, we saw that they used bolts, nuts and bolts. So basically, pieces of metal that are taped to the explosive, so that when it goes off, it causes maximum harm. What's important to find out is the type of explosive that was used. ISIS has typically used something called TATP, triacetone triperoxide, in their attacks in Europe. This is a peroxide-based explosive, and you've, our listeners have heard of the term peroxide blonde. This is a chemical that is very easily bought at drugstores and at hair salons, so it's very difficult to control, and that's one of the reasons that ISIS has repeatedly used it in attacks in Europe.
The 22-year-old Salman Abidi, that the police in Manchester say committed this suicide bombing, was a British national of Libyan descent. How important is it that he was a British national, apparently born there? We seem to have lost our guest, Rukmini Kalamaki. Once again, she is the reporter on terrorism, including al-Qaeda and ISIS. She's now back with us. What about the fact that he was apparently a British national?
That's not surprising. Most of the attacks that have been carried out in Europe have been carried out by ISIS attackers who were trained by the group or also inspired by the group, and almost all of them were nationals of European countries. We saw that during the Paris attacks, during the Brussels attacks, and now here.
You said that ISIS is disciplined only in the claims that it makes. You said also, or I gather you believe, that there are some contradictions in the report that it put out, the claim that it put out. What are
yes.
they?
So ISIS claimed responsibility first through an outlet called Mashir. This is one of their channels that they have on the messaging app Telegram. We've seen them use this channel before. That very first statement claimed that explosive devices had been placed at the scene. So it suggested that there was not a suicide bomber. Instead, bombs were left at the scene. A couple of minutes later, the Amaq news agency, which is ISIS's news agency and which presumably is run by a different member of the organization, put out a conflicting report saying that a security detachment had carried out the attack. That Amaq claim was very quickly deleted, and a few minutes after that, they put out a second one saying that a fighter of the Islamic State carried out the attack. Now, it's unclear what is going on. It could be that the media apparatus of the Islamic State has been disrupted by the heavy fighting in Mosul and by the pushback that the group has faced in its territory.
Okay. We're going to have to end it at this point. Thank you so much, as always, Rukmini Kalamaki with The New York Times, for bringing us up to date on what might or might have happened in Manchester and who might be responsible. Great to talk with you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In a moment, President Trump in search of the ultimate deal.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. President Trump went to Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank today and met with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. Back in Israel, the president declared once again that peace is possible between Israel and the Palestinians.
As I have repeatedly said, I'm personally committed to helping Israelis and Palestinians achieve a peace agreement. And I had a meeting this morning with President Abbas and can tell you that the Palestinians are ready to reach for peace. I know you've heard it before. I am telling you, that's what I do. They are ready to reach for peace.
Luke Baker is Jerusalem bureau chief for Reuters. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Has the president in that speech said anything new and different? That has there been some change in the Palestinians?
I really don't think so, no. I think what he offered was a lot of sort of bold words and reassurance and trying to create an atmosphere of confidence and sort of backslapping sort of bonhomie and saying, you know, I know how confident and ready you are. But the fact is the situation hasn't changed. I don't think either side is any closer to taking the first steps towards returning to negotiations. And the framework for any process towards a peace deal just isn't there. So really, I would say that this sort of 28-hour trip to Israel and the Palestinian territory really amounted to a lot of optics and a lot of confident language, but without any substance to back it up.
The President's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has been put in charge of many, many things, but that includes the making peace with the Palestinians and the Israelis. Is there any possibility that behind the scenes he's been working something out?
Well, you know, we spent a long time in advance of this trip trying to understand exactly what Jared Kushner may have up his sleeve. And I think, you know, the short way of summarizing that is that he does seem to have spent a great deal of time talking to people. Most of the people who have, at a high level, who have spoken to him are extremely discreet about those contacts. They almost don't want to be mentioned as having had much contact with him. And no one is really willing to sort of lay out what sort of parameters he's presented. I think they really see him as still in listening mode. They say that he's serious, he listens well, he's intelligent, he's trying to take the most sort of cautious and engaged approach that he possibly can while leaving the day-to-day work to Jason Greenblatt, a lawyer for the Trump Organization who has been shuttling around the region and who also has received very positive sort of feedback from people that have met him. But in all of that, there's nothing substantive that anyone can say that the Trump administration doctrine on the Middle East, tearing up the old rule book, if you like, and presenting something new, a new initiative or a new way of doing things, there is nothing that replaces the old way of doing things at this point. And I can't see between everything that's being said and everything that's being sort of talked about that there is something, some special structure underpinning it. I think we have to wait some time longer to see if that emerges.
This has such a long history, and of course the peace talks have been stalled for the past 3 years. Among the people you've talked to is Dennis Ross. Our listeners might be familiar to him. He was the Middle East peace envoy for President George H.W. Bush and President Bill Clinton, and for a while worked for President Obama as well. What does he say? Does he say anything new happening?
No, again, I think, you know, no one is willing to write this off. No one wants to say that the Trump administration is going nowhere, rapidly. What they're tending to say is, you know, okay, they've said they've made this a priority. He's appointed his son-in-law, which, you know, of course, Jared Kushner has a great number of responsibilities within the White House administration, but this is one of the earliest appointments he received. And certainly for an Orthodox Jew who has a connection with the land of Israel, it would seem to be one of the more prominent things that he wants to be involved in. He can draw on resources. He's met with people like Tony Blair, with Dennis Ross, with others. So he's treating it seriously, and I don't think anyone's dismissing them out of hand. But, you know, we're 4 months into the presidency, and Trump has clearly made this a priority by making this one of the first places he's visited. And at the same time, given this opportunity to say something, he pretty much avoided any of the issues that could have been tackled on this trip. He didn't mention settlements. He didn't mention a 50th anniversary of occupation coming up. He didn't mention moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He didn't mention the words Palestinian state. He didn't even talk about Palestinian self-determination. So effectively, he avoided any language that could have been in any way controversial or have shunted the discussion in some direction.
Were the Palestinians disappointed, particularly after he met with Mahmoud Abbas, that he didn't say anything about a two-state solution?
Well, in a way, you know, yes, they are, put bluntly. But at the same time, they're almost relieved that he didn't talk about moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And you could say that the Israelis are relieved that he didn't talk about a Palestinian state. So at some very basic level, you could say that both sides got something that was a particular, potentially a concern for them. But, you know, those issues shouldn't really have been there in any case. I think from the Palestinian point of view, the concern has to be that he met with Abbas in the White House earlier this month, May 3rd, praised him, talked about engagement, and yet failed to mention the words Palestinian state or any recognition or understanding, I think, in their discussion of the issues that need to be resolved over, you know, occupation, et cetera. While at the same time, you know, in 28 hours, he spent 1 hour with President Abbas in the Palestinian territory and 27 hours, if you like, on the Israeli side. And he made his main speech in Israel. It was extremely complimentary and had lots of warm words for the state of Israel and its history, its attachment to Jerusalem and the land. And I think, you know, they would come away with the sense that, you know, he kept up the language of the best friend of Israel. While he didn't talk about moving the embassy, I don't think anyone really expected that to happen. And the fact that he didn't mention a Palestinian state is both negative for the Palestinians and positive for the Israelis.
Okay, so both sides got something, but it was more what was left out than what was included. Again, Luke Baker is a Jerusalem bureau chief for Reuters. Amir Tibon is a Haaretz correspondent in Washington. At the moment, he is in Israel. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, happy to be here.
How do you think Israelis, with 27 hours as opposed to just 1 hour, are responding to the president's visit?
Well, I think President Trump came to Israel as someone that was already a pretty popular president here in Israel. And he's leaving even more popular because during the a little more than a day that he spent here, Israelis pretty much heard from him everything they wanted to hear. He said he's going to have Israel's back. He's going to support Israel. He had very harsh statements against Iran, which most Israelis view as their main enemy. And he also talked about peace with the Palestinians, which even now when there's a right-wing government in Israel, still most Israelis would like to see. There's a discussion of, you know, how to get it, how it can be achieved. But nobody, or at least most Israelis, you know, do like to hear this combination of we're going to have your back, we're going to support you. And if possible, we're also going to have a peace deal, and it's going to be so great. That's basically what Trump said, and I don't know many audiences that would not be happy about that kind of message.
What about the so-called intelligence sharing incident with the two Russian diplomats in the Oval Office, with Mr. Trump pretty much confirming that it occurred by saying yesterday that he never mentioned the word Israel?
So I think that when Trump came here, this was actually the biggest obstacle that he was facing, because this story that broke last week did, for the first time, I think, cause many Israelis to maybe change their view of him, maybe think, wait, there could be a problem here. The idea that the United States president would actually put Israeli intelligence collection in danger, cause some kind of harm, was very surprising and unusual for Israelis. But I think Trump managed during this trip to cancel the damages, at least among the Israeli public. I don't know. I'm not sure that the Israeli intelligence agencies, the people who actually know the details of this leak and what it caused, are going to forgive and you know, be very happy about it anytime soon. But the Israeli public was swayed by his speeches and his statements. And this thing, I can tell you that I know in the United States, the Intel leak actually made headlines in the last 24 hours because of what Trump said here about it. But in Israel, it was not the main headline for most of the visit, but rather what Trump said, whether it was about peace or about supporting Israel, those kinds of statements.
Is that partly because there is a division between the right-wing politicians in Israel and the security and intelligence communities, who tend, as I understand it, to be more on the left side of things than they are on the right?
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize it necessarily as left and right, but I would say that the vast majority of the senior security chiefs in Israel over the last two decades have been supportive of attempts to reach peace agreements, have been critical of many of the steps of the right-wing governments in Israel, including the current one led by Netanyahu. And I think that, for example, if we're looking at the issue of moving the embassy to Jerusalem, when Trump was about to enter the White House, and this was in the news all the time, our newspaper reported that the Israeli security establishment basically told the government, you know, if this happens, if the embassy moves, there's going to be a big mess, and it's going to be dirty, and maybe people are going to die. And we later heard Secretary of State Rex Tillerson saying, you know what, we're not sure even the Israelis are so fond of this move. Of course, after he said that, Netanyahu went out and put out a statement that he wants the embassy moved and it's important to him. But this is just one small example of how there's this distance between what the politicians say because they need to get elected and what the professionals in the security establishment say because they actually need to keep our country safe. And those two things don't always work in the same direction.
Amir Tibon, again, the correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in Washington. He's currently in Israel. Shibli Talhami is with us, peace and development professor at the University of Maryland, director of the Critical Issues Poll. He's also a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
What is your take on the president's trip so far and the reaction from both sides?
Well, you know, this is, of course, aimed at rulers in the Middle East. He has had a great success in consolidating relations with Arab rulers in Saudi Arabia. He's developed a personal relationship with Mahmoud Abbas. Clearly, he's had a good relationship with Netanyahu. He's probably reached out to the Israeli public through the speech today. But he has completely ignored Arab public opinion. And it is striking in that regard because most of the public sees this as theater. Trump is popular among rulers. They see him as a strategic ally on issues like Iran, ISIS. They don't see him pushing on democracy and human rights. They embrace him. They want to make a deal with him. But the public looks at all this as theater. No one is really taking it seriously. And when you're looking at the priority issue for Trump, which is fighting ISIS and militant groups, which, by the way, is still ranked as the top issue among the American public. In fact, over the weekend, while Trump was in the Middle East, I carried out an American public opinion poll that I'm releasing the next 2 days, where still by far ISIS is the number one priority, way ahead of the Iran issue. And the second issue is actually Syria, and then the Arab-Israeli issue, then Iran. And on the fighting of ISIS, if you don't try to win the hearts and minds of people, how are you going to deal with it? So he's looking at all the issues as if I make a deal with rulers and we can go fight these external enemies like terrorist groups and militias, and everything will be fine. So that's the way it comes across. Now, on Israel-Palestine, it's interesting because it's a little bit more complicated than that, because I think certainly the Palestinian Authority is looking to him a little bit. Everybody's been surprised that he hasn't carried through with some of the threats that he made during the campaign, like moving the American embassy to Jerusalem, like giving Israel total free hands on settlements. So, and then comes this president of the only superpower and says, I'm going to make this issue, your issue, a priority issue for me when no one else thinks it's strategically important anymore. And how could they say no to him? So in a way, the Palestinians are up to a point heartened by this. And also, I think the secret is out in all the palaces in the Middle East, that in order to win this man, in order to have him on your side, in order to not suffer his wrath, compliment him as much as you could. This is a man who loves adoration. So they're showering him with every conceivable compliment you can imagine.
Well, let me interrupt you for a moment because Amir Tibon needs to leave us. He's again the Haaretz correspondent in Washington, currently speaking to us from Israel. Do you agree? Do you think that the Israeli populace also sees all this as theater?
Well, I think that, you know, we'll have to wait and see. It's obvious that so far what we've heard from Trump is a lot of nice and beautiful words. Whether it was what he said about peace or about supporting Israel. And to some extent, by the way, even what he's been saying about Iran, he's been so tough on Iran, but when came the time to decide whether to scrap the nuclear deal that Obama signed or to keep it in place, his administration decided for now to keep it in place. And so we're hearing a lot of big words about deals and agreements and the new policy, but there were really no specifics in this trip, almost on any issue. And it seems like this administration still needs to actually convince people that beyond the nice words, it has policies that can back it up.
Okay. Again, Amir Tibon is the Haaretz correspondent in Washington. Now, we're going to take a very brief break and come back, continue this conversation on our talking point later. Former and current intelligence officials went on the record today answering questions in public about possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, we're not only back with To The Point, talking today about the president's trip to the Middle East, and Amir Tabun still with us, Haaretz correspondent in Washington. He will be having to leave right away. But I just wanted to ask you, you have a book upcoming about the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. What can you tell us about him? Is he genuinely optimistic? Does he really have any authority beyond the Palestinian Authority? How is he regarded, for example, in Gaza?
It's a great question. The book, the title for the book is The Last Palestinian. And that comes from the fact that Mahmoud Abbas, who is now 82, is really the last member of the founding generation of the Palestinian National Movement. He was there when, with Yasser Arafat, who was the original leader of this movement and later the first leader of the Palestinian Authority that was founded in the 1990s. Mahmoud Abbas is a refugee. He and his family lost their home in the war of 1948 that led to the creation of Israel. And he's really been a person that his own biography tells the story of his people, of the Palestinian people. And after he's gone, there probably won't be another Palestinian leader with that kind of life story, with that kind of background, who can speak for his entire people, those in the West Bank, the refugees who live in the Palestinian diaspora, the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, and those in Gaza. But at the same time, it's true that over the years, especially in the last 10 years, his authority has been reduced. He's lost a lot of his power, mainly because of the way that he lost control in Gaza in the year 2007, when his political rivals, the Islamists from Hamas, took over. And I can't answer the million-dollar question, which is, can you get a peace deal with him? But what I can say that is that, obviously, all the previous attempts to reach an agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians at the end of the day failed because of internal politics, whether it's on the Israeli side, on the Palestinian side. And if the Trump administration wants to get serious about this, they're going to have to really look into how Abbas's political standing is on the Palestinian street. And I think that really corresponds with what Professor Telfami said, that basically you can't do this kind of thing, work on a peace deal, if you ignore the public opinion, if you ignore the political constraints of the Palestinian leader. In the past, American administrations, in my opinion, were much more focused about the internal politics of Israel, which is a parliamentary democracy, and it's sometimes easier to understand. But if anyone really wants to get this thing done with Abbas, at the end of the day, his own public standing and the way he can speak for the people in the West Bank and in Gaza is going to be a big part of the story.
And how old is he?
Well, he was born in 1935. So he's really, out of this group with Trump and Netanyahu, he's the oldest. And there's been, he's been in power ever since the year 2005. We're talking about someone who's been on the scene for quite a long time. And this might really be kind of like the last chance to get something for him. And like I said, also for the Americans and Israelis, perhaps the last opportunity to speak to someone who can say that he is really speaking for the entire Palestinian people.
Amir Tabun, again, Haaretz correspondent in Washington, speaking to us from Israel. Thanks so much for being on our program, giving us that insight into how complicated this situation is as Mr. Trump makes his first diplomatic efforts. Laura Rosen is with us, Al Monitor's diplomatic correspondent based in Washington. She extensively covered the Iran nuclear negotiations, and we have already raised the subject of the demonizing of Iran by the president, both in the Gulf state of Saudi Arabia and in Israel. Laura Rosen, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
What are the consequences of what the president's saying about Iran and the effort to get these two different entities, Israel and the Gulf states, together in their opposition to Iran?
Well, I think like what Amir and Luke and Shibley were saying is, Trump gave all the reassurance to the Saudis and the traditional Sunni American allies, and Israel that they've wanted and they felt, you know, that maybe Obama had been leaning away from. So in terms of just making them feel good, I think Trump delivered. Making them feel like the U.S. had their back, was not looking, you know, for a big rapprochement with Iran. In some ways, even without drastically changing U.S. policy towards Iran, I think that's partly what Netanyahu wanted to hear, and the Saudi king as well. When Trump was kind of bashing the Iran deal that Obama had made with Netanyahu yesterday, you know, he said, "I can't believe they gave him such a good, Iranian such a good deal, and the Iranians should be grateful." And then he didn't make any commitment to change anything at all. He kind of moved on. And Netanyahu later thanked him for enunciating, you know, a tougher Iran policy. You know, so maybe part of the strategy, if Trump has one on this trip, is kind of like a big hug. Get your traditional allies to feel comfortable enough to make the kind of concessions you might ask for later on.
Iran just had an election and has chosen to re-elect the more moderate of the choices available, namely Mr. Rouhani, who was one of the negotiators of the Iran deal. And it's my understanding that Iranians danced in the streets, particularly younger ones, as a result of that election. What are the consequences of isolating Iran at a time when it appears that a lot of the people there would really like to see the country reach out and be more a part of the whole world?
Right. I think there'd be a lot of disappointment, certainly from, as you saw, the 41 million people who voted for Rouhani, who really in the last days of the campaign was pressing against a lot of the Supreme Leader's red lines, talking about negotiating with the West on non-nuclear issues. The Supreme Leader has previously forbade that with the U.S. and, you know, talking about getting non-nuclear sanctions lifted, which would mean talking with the U.S. about a lot of very sensitive stuff that, you know, is basically Iran's posture in the regions, Iran's ballistic missile program. So he gave an interesting press conference yesterday, Rouhani. Iranians are showing that they're not too fazed by Trump's leaning into the Saudis and the Israelis and tough talk. They're going to wait and see. And it was interesting. Secretary of State Tillerson in Riyadh on Saturday said, you know, I don't have plans to call my Iranian counterpart yet, but I expect that, you know, I'll talk with him at the right time. So I think they do expect that there might be an engagement part of their strategy at some point.
What about the Iranian reaction to what we're hearing, though, from the president and the others in the region? You're saying that they're just going to wait and see?
Well, I think the leadership, you know, Rouhani has been around, as you said, with the nuclear deal going back to the 2005. And so, you know, he understands Trump's still getting his team together, that they have a view, you know, including of Obama being too soft on Iran. So I think, you know, Rouhani was expressing, like, we'll probably get to negotiations at some point, but, you know, let the Trump people kind of do their reviews and figure out what they're doing and hire some more staff, by the way. I think for, you know, more ordinary Iranians, people, you know, people I follow on Twitter, you know, they feel like Trump has forgotten that a lot of the people who did 9/11 were Saudis, right? And they think that, you know, Trump says he wants to fight ISIS, but he's ignoring that Iran and the U.S., in their opinion, are on the same side of that fight. So I think they feel frustrated that, you know, Trump's bought into the Sunni narrative of the region to such a degree.
Laura Rosen again with Al Monitor. I want to go back to Luke Baker, the first guest on our program, Jerusalem bureau chief for Reuters. How does the anti-Iran agenda go down with Israelis and with Palestinians?
I think from the Israeli side, everything that Trump said was very much music to their ears. They want to hear a tough line on Iran. They want to feel, they do feel that Iran is their sort of, as Amir mentioned, you know, the prime threat to Israel's existence. And so they want to see, you know, strong language and the idea that if needs be, you know, further steps can be taken. But let's get back to the fundamentals. I don't think Netanyahu probably has said that he wants to reopen the Iran deal and would encourage Trump to do that. But I don't think they want to massively overhaul it, even if they were able to reopen it. And even then, I think there's a recognition that the deal that was struck while they can talk about it being weak and being too generous, ultimately does a lot to stave off the risk or the threat of Iran gaining a nuclear weapons capability. So they recognize that in lots of ways the deal was successful and achieved, you know, a good amount of what was required. And certainly from the security agencies in Israel and the military intelligence agencies, they recognize that it performs a lot of what they hoped could be achieved. So, you know, I see this as a lot of, you know, the normal advice is, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick. Trump and Netanyahu are not talking softly. They're talking loudly and pretending to carry a big stick, but probably not going to deliver it. So I think, anyway, the language is very much what Israelis want to hear and what Netanyahu likes to hear from Trump. And I think the Iranians probably aren't too worried about it because it's a lot of verbal gymnastics without anything actually changing. From the Palestinian side, the Palestinian Mahmoud Abbas flew to Saudi Arabia for the meetings that Trump had there and sat with the Muslim leaders and listened to a lot of the language that was, you know, largely a rallying cry against, in lots of ways, against Iran and its growing influence or perceived growing influence in the region. I don't think the Palestinians see the language on Iran as being sort of extraordinary or anything that they're going to disagree with. They pretty much are going to follow the line of other Sunni Arab states, like the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and the Gulf states, in opposing sort of any growing Iranian influence in the region.
Let me go back to Shibli Tilhami again, peace and development professor at the University of Maryland and director of the Critical Issues Poll, also a fellow at the Brookings Institution. When you poll, can you tell us, do you think that President Trump has taken any risks with his own supporters here in the United States about anything that he said on this trip or anything that he's done?
Well, actually, in terms of atmospherics, he really spoke to them, particularly in terms of the symbols, speaking from Jerusalem, addressing particularly the evangelical right, where he has tremendous support. I poll among the evangelicals, and I'm even writing a book about them, and they are his biggest supporters. The problem for him is he has pitched compromise. He even said that in the speech. He didn't give any indications about what compromise meant, but he said both sides have to compromise. And among the American public, he has a lot of support. The majority of Americans, the latest poll, 60%, want Trump to take an even-handed approach toward Israel-Palestine. But his base, the Republicans, those who voted for him, and particularly the evangelical right, a majority of them want him to decidedly take Israel's side. In fact, in the polling that I did just last month on this, the Republicans say that they admire Netanyahu specifically as the single most important national world leader after Trump himself. So, in a way, his base expects him to take Israel's side at the same time that he's trying to do some mediation, and that tells you something about the nature of his speech in Israel. It was full of symbolism, embracing Israel history, linking Judaism, Christianity, Bible, all of the symbolism, but nothing to do with specifics. And so in that sense, he probably scored with his base by avoiding real concrete steps.
Laura Rosen, what about Iranians and the demonizing of their country by Mr. Trump and I mean ordinary Iranians, not just the leadership, and their neighbors in that part of the world, and the constant refrain that they're going to expand and so on? And, of course, they do support Hezbollah and other terrorist activities.
Yeah, you know, there were some interesting moments at the end of the Iranian campaign where you had a former mayor of one of the Iranian cities saying, you know, why is Iran supporting, you know, Assad in Syria? And, I mean, really unusual comments. And I think he might have gotten rebuked for those comments. But there are actually foreign policy debates in Iran, and you know, I think if the U.S. and Iran actually did get to some sort of negotiations, as Rouhani said he was interested in, even under the Trump administration, one of the foremost issues would be the one that concerns Israel, which is Hezbollah. And Iran's, you know, Iran supports Hezbollah partly as a deterrent against Israel.
Sure.
And Israel's very concerned about that. So I think that, you know, more than ballistic missiles, but I think the Hezbollah issue, red lines on that, Some understanding on Iran's presence in Syria, would be interesting things for them to pursue. And Trump, you know, you have to look at it from Israel's perspective or Saudi Arabia's perspective. I mean, perhaps the fact that Trump has come out so strong against Iran does give him a little leverage coming into talks. You know, are the Iranians going to give him more because they have to than they were prepared to give Obama because he's a tough negotiator or, you know, he thinks he's a tough negotiator. I don't know.
We will see. Shibley Talhami, very quickly, you poll the evangelicals. 81% of them are for Donald Trump. How are they going to feel about his visit to the Vatican?
Well, I think they don't mind that, frankly. It's a symbolism of Christianity. And the Pope is admired even by some of them. People don't understand that. It's not about Catholicism versus evangelism. I think the fact that he's pitching religion and faith probably will play well with them.
So, Luke Baker, quickly, back to you again, our Jerusalem bureau chief for Reuters. Do you think that Mr. Trump has achieved a great deal as far as people in the Middle East are concerned and leadership in the Middle East?
No, I think, well, to put, you know, just very briefly, I don't think he's achieved a great deal yet. But I think, as Laura mentioned, he's done a lot of good backslapping. He's used the right language. He's tried to create confidence. He's tried to sort of, if you like, jimmy people along, whether it's Netanyahu or Bass or the Saudi King Salman, who he's mentioned multiple times, even in Israel. So he's trying to play the kind of backslapping deal maker who's everyone's friend and can offer something. But I think, you know, and people are pretty happy to play along with that game for a while. The truth, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and the eating will be when he actually has to present something concrete that people can get their teeth into. And I think when he does that, unless they've done their homework and present something really concrete and meaningful that people can respond to, it's going to end up looking like much more of a failure.
All right. Once again, the president has moved on to Rome. We'll be hearing more about that as time goes on. Luke Baker, Jerusalem bureau chief for Reuters. Amir Tibon, our earlier guest with Haaretz in Washington. Shibley Talhami at the University of Maryland, director of the Critical Issues Poll, also at the Brookings Institution. And Laura Rosen, Monitor's diplomatic correspondent in Washington. Thank you also very much for being on our program today. In a moment, former and current officials go on the record. This is To the Point from Public Radio International. Well, we're not here with today's talking point. Yesterday, the Washington Post reported that President Trump asked two top intelligence officials to help him push back against the FBI's investigation into ties between his campaign and Russia. Today, in a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Chairman John McCain read that story, and he posed a question to Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, who was one of the two officials named in the story.
Is that an accurate reporting? Director Coates.
Mr. Chairman, as the President's principal intelligence advisor, I'm fortunate to be able and need to spend a significant amount of time with the President discussing national security interest and intelligence as it relates to those interests. We discuss a number of topics on a very regular basis. I have always believe that given the nature of my position and the information in which we share, it's not appropriate for me to comment publicly on any of that. So on this topic, as well as other topics, I don't feel it's appropriate to characterize discussions and conversations with the President.
Adam Entis is the Washington Post reporter who broke that story yesterday. Hi, Adam. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Well, he didn't deny it.
Yes, and a little bit later on in the hearing, he was asked a hypothetical question, which was, how would you, not going into specifics, how would you handle such a situation? And what Coates said is that he made his position clear to the White House that he didn't want intelligence judgments to be shaped by any political shaping, as he worded it. Obviously, we have from multiple officials, not only that Coates himself was asked by President Trump to try to push back at this collusion allegations that the FBI was investigating, but also that the National Security Agency Director Rogers was got a similar request from the president.
How do you judge the statement that was made today by the Director of National Intelligence?
Clearly he's in a difficult position. I mean, he does meet with the president regularly to go through intelligence that the DNI, the director, as the Office of Director of National Intelligence, presents to him, and for him to talk publicly about those conversations would obviously be potentially problematic. But at the same time, given the acute attention to these issues right now, there is a great deal of interest on the Hill to get to the bottom of it. What was Trump doing in terms of pushing back, if at all, to the FBI investigation that Director Comey was leading until he was fired earlier this month?
You reported that both Coates and Rogers refused the president's request to try to downplay the investigation. When Mr. Coates said, as you indicated later in the hearing, that he had made his position clear to the White House, was that almost a confirmation, do you think, of what had been said? He could have done that before the president asked him the question.
Well, it was very clear from the question that the senator asking the question wanted to get at hypotheticals. And so he was responding to a hypothetical and made clear that he believed that that it was important that, he deliver information, intelligence relevant to policymakers so that they can base their judgments on without political shaping affecting that presentation of the intelligence. So he was trying to basically make clear that any political shaping, is using his words, of the intelligence would not be appropriate. And so while he was speaking there in generalities and not specifically addressing the question of his contacts and his communications with the president, he wanted to make, I think, clear that, as he said during his confirmation hearings, that he wasn't going to be swayed by, a political leader putting pressure on him to shape the intelligence in a particular way.
When you talk to people off the record, did they indicate that they thought the president was, in fact, trying to politically shape the controversy?
Well, I think, the officials we spoke to thought and they said that Coates and Rogers were both found this request to be problematic and inappropriate. They did not consider it appropriate for them to speak publicly about an ongoing FBI investigation, and also to talk about intelligence that's not only classified, effectively, if they were to do what the president seemed to be asking them to do, they would be undermining Director Comey at the FBI and basically casting doubt on what the FBI was investigating.
All right. Much is made, of course, of the current and former officials involved in all of this as sources of the story. On the other side of Capitol Hill, the former CIA chief John Brennan told the House Intelligence Committee the FBI investigation was well-founded and that Russia's interference in the election was brazen.
I encountered and am aware of information and intelligence that revealed contacts and interactions between Russian officials and U.S. persons involved in the Trump campaign that I was concerned about because of known Russian efforts to suborn such individuals. And it raised questions in my mind, again, whether or not the Russians were able to gain the cooperation of those individuals. I don't know whether or not such collusion, that's your term, such collusion existed. I don't know.
And when he says that's your term, he's referring to somebody on the committee. So back to Adam Entis. Here is the former chief of the CIA talking about the possibility that the Russians had individuals in mind, certain individuals, and he seems to know who they were.
Right. So, you know, I think for the listener to understand what was going on is, you know, the National Security Agency, the CIA, they were spying on the Russians. And while they were spying on the Russians, they were picking up information in the Russian communications. They were just either talking directly to what Brennan describes as a U.S. person. So this would be, you know, an American who works for Trump on the campaign or in some other capacity. And they were picking up the Russians and they were getting information about the Americans, or the Russians were talking about their communications with the Americans. That's what he's referring to. So these are basically contacts. These are exchanges to, from, and about these members of the Trump campaign that the Russians were either in direct contact with or were discussing their earlier contacts with. And this is what he's referring to. What he's saying is that there is a lot of questions about the nature of those communications. And like he said, he doesn't know the answer when he leaves on January 20th, the job. He doesn't know if there was really evidence of collusion, that, in other words, the Russian government and its efforts to try to basically, you know, help Trump by releasing the emails damaging to Hillary Clinton, were doing so somehow in coordination with members of the Trump team.
Your story and others, a chain of them by The Washington Post, have certainly brought a lot to light about this. And the Congress has taken notice and is really beginning to get very serious about investigating. Do you think that there will be a bipartisan investigation as a consequence of all that we know now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure what's going to happen on the Hill. I mean, clearly you have the Republicans who are more interested, it seems, in pursuing this, you know, what they describe as the leaks and the unmaskings, as they're describing it. This would be the times when Obama administration officials asked their intelligence briefers to reveal the identities of those U.S. persons whose names appeared in these intelligence reports when the U.S. was spying on Russia. They seem more interested in that and also in investigating the leaks, which would be stories, you know, that appeared in The Washington Post and other publications going into the details of these contacts that Brennan is referring to. So, that, you know, obviously that is potentially going to dampen the ability of the Democrats and the Republicans on the two intelligence committees to work closely together. Separate from that, though, there is a special counsel that's just been named that is going to take over running of the FBI's investigation, and obviously that that has you know, will be pursued by the professionals.
Adam Entis, we're out of time. Washington Post, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.